Hello, is this Nils Lofgren?
Yeah, can you hold on one sec?
Sure, of course.
Hi, it's Nils.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, great. How's it going?
Real good. This is Uncle Bernie, or Bernie, you can just call me, from Nergasm. And
my name's Jay.
Jay in the studio, and we got one other person still yet to come. So.
Tommy O. He'll be coming later because he's coming from Connecticut.
Oh, okay, great. So this will be taped, right?
Yeah, taping it right now.
Beautiful. Okay, give me one second, all right?
Okay.
Just getting settled here in my hotel. Hold on.
Yeah, give you as many seconds as you want.
It's weird that it's still called taped, even though it's not, you don't use tape anymore.
That's
it.
Just part of the lexicon, as they say.
Just like records. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, records. Kleenex. Xerox.
Well, those are trade names, actually.
Yeah, I know, but they became,
But I mean, no, it's not, you don't use tape anymore. It's not actually recording on tape. It's being digitized. That was the point I was making.
Yeah, but it's just that people assume a word, even if it's a trade word, it'll hopefully be for a company.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. I'm sorry, fellas. Here I am.
Excellent.
Thanks very much for this, Neil.
Hey, I'm thrilled that someone is letting people know I make music.
Well,
we'd be happy to.
We appeal to an eclectic audience, and since we're kind of a hobby station,
yeah, pretty much.
We don't have to bow to anyone. We play music that you don't hear anywhere else.
That's beautiful. Thank God for stations like yours, because there's not a lot of them.
And that kind of brings me to a point that Tommy O wanted to ask, and that was, well, how come your music isn't played on the radio?
Well, and here he is right now. I hit the road in 68 with my band Grin, and it is a business, so we made four albums, and same kind of thing. We had a lot of critical success, but not really commercial success, meaning a hit record. And the companies, it wasn't that adversarial, it was just like, hey, this is the real music business world, and you're not making us money, so we're going to have to part company. And we couldn't really get a decent record deal, and we had a great run as a band. We didn't want to go back and kind of play covers. I mean, we had an extraordinary, four-album, six-year run with David Briggs producing us, Neil Young's producer. And so we tried to go out with some class, did a farewell concert at Kennedy Center, and A&M Records took quite a few months to decide whether or not to let me continue as a solo artist, which I really didn't want to do, but of course, I was a professional musician. I had to do something, so even though I love being in bands, I carried on, and same kind of thing. Made a lot of records I'm proud of, never had a hit. So for the last 13, 14 years now, I've been on my own with my website, nilslofgren.com, which is kind of the future for me. I'm just trying to make music I'm proud of, sing and play a lot. And it's a bit off the grid and grassroots, but, thanks to the internet and stations like yours spreading the word, just planning on, doing stuff I'm proud of and spreading the word slowly but surely and trying to get better at what I do. So it's just a function of commerce and the nature of the record business. They really want to work with artists that are selling lots of records, and you can't blame them.
Yeah, I agree with you on the internet part, though. It gives, someone who's small budget and eclectic like us a chance to get to others like-minded people, shall we say, and get stuff like yours out. And
Yeah, that's great. Now, I just realized last September was 38 years on the road, and
wow.
Got a lot of great stories and great experiences, and I hope more to come, and I'm grateful to be singing and playing, and I think I'm getting better slowly but surely, so it's kind of exciting to have the freedom that you kind of felt like you started with, and I managed to always maintain, but as the industry changed, it got to be a little more hands-on, and you kind of had to play more. You felt like kind of a psychiatrist sometimes, just trying to convince the company they were involved, but somehow doing what you felt was right musically with your producer anyway. And it got much more oppressive and hands-on as time went by, and that's why about 13 years ago I decided to head out on my own.
Yeah, right on. I heard Joni Mitchell make the same kind of observation, too.
Love Joni Mitchell. She actually, way back in the Tonight's the Night tour with Neil Young, we did that album in 72 or 3, I think, and while we were making the record, she came by the SIR studios and sat in with us a bit. I didn't realize it at the time, but Neil told us that was the first time she'd ever played an electric guitar.
Wow.
And she got one of her fancy cool tunings, and Neil encouraged her to just, you know, pick a song. I guess we did this song Raison Robbery, which wound up on one of her records.
Yeah, it's a great tune.
But somewhere in the Tonight's the Night vault is a very funky, dark version of that with Joni on electric and the Tonight's the Night band backing her up.
Well, we'll have to see if we can unearth that and get it on the...
well, that would be beautiful. Good luck.
It's what we do.
Nils, this is T.O. the Mofo. I just got here.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well, and you sound great.
I am. I actually did a challenging... anyway, 2 days ago was my birthday. I turned 56, which is a little overwhelming.
Which is kind of funny, because I am also 56.
As am I.
Hey, listen, it's good to be alive. And I got a great wife and a stepson out in Arizona, but I just headed out about a day and a half ago. I flew to Newark Airport, crashed, rented a car, and today I drove myself to Mohegan Sun Casino up in Connecticut.
Yeah, that's out in my neck of the woods. That's why it took me a while to get here.
Yeah, and then tomorrow I've got a kind of a private function for these corporate guys with some great friends, Mark Rivera and Crystal from the Billy Joel Band.
Wow.
And Andy York from Andy York from the John Mellencamp Band, and Will Lee from the David Letterman Band.
Wow.
So, it's all going great, and I'm glad to be playing. We're going to just do some jams tomorrow night, and then in July I've got some shows in Annapolis and New York City with my brother and a friend, some acoustic shows.
Is that Tommy?
So I'm still at it, plugging away, trying to promote my last record, Sacred Weapon, and quite a long live acoustic DVD that we put out. And so I'm just glad to be alive and feel like I'm playing and singing well and trying to stay in shape. And, you know, as you must know, then being 56, it's not all fun and games. You got to kind of pay a little more attention to health as you get older. But the good news is if you do, you know, hopefully I can apply some slowly earned and learned wisdom along the way in this crazy business. And I'm really enjoying being in front of an audience more than I ever did, so that's a good thing.
That's good news.
Let me take one second, okay?
Yep.
Just again, you know, got five animals at home and wife and son on the road. Let me make sure this call wasn't anything urgent. I'll be right back with you, okay?
Yep.
Hold on one sec.
Sure.
Sorry, fellas, I'm back.
That's okay.
Nothing to be sorry about.
I get nervous. I love animals, but I try not to have any because I'm always leaving. And now I got a family. We got five animals, three dogs and two cats.
Nice,
you know, we got friends that help out, but leaving that many living creatures under your care when you take off all the time. My wife and son went to San Diego for the weekend, so you always want to monitor the home front.
Well, the cats are okay.
We're good, like I said, I'm just glad to be singing and playing and got some gigs coming up, which is pretty much my favorite thing to do, is get up in front of an audience, play and sing.
Wow, good thing.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about Willie Nelson on Sacred Weapon. How long have you known Willie, and how did that come about?
Well, a couple years ago, his last TV show called Willie and Friends, where he sings with his friends, and I was in the backup band that backed him up in L.A., and got to meet him. And I don't know Willie well, but he's always been very kind. And his manager, Mark Rothbaum, who's a good friend, just has kind of a kindness. He's kind of sympathetic to my off-the-grid, no record company journey, putting out music on my website. And while I was making Sacred Weapon, he actually surprised me with the idea. He said, hey, why don't you pick a song and let me see if I can get Willie to do a duet. And, of course, it was a great honor, and I went through the chain of command and picked In Your Hands, which was really the first song I wrote on Bottleneck Dobro. It was a Christmas present for my wife, Amy. Sent a demo, and Mark had Willie check it out, and Willie was up for trying it, and their guitarist was sick during the Kennedy Center Honors two Christmases ago, so I came and did the guitar playing for Willie, and I was mixing the song in Virginia with Billy Wolf, a great engineer who mixed the album and mastered it. And after the morning rehearsal for the Kennedy Centers, we got on Willie's bus and drove out to Virginia, and he sang beautifully, and just, you know, that incredibly soulful, warm voice, and it just took the whole song up a notch, and it was certainly a highlight for me of the record.
That song has a great feel to it, because your and Willie's voices seem to blend very well on that.
Thank you. It was also a case of, as I've just kind of matured, hopefully, as a singer, for something like that, that you want to have more of an intimate, warm feel, you put in a little bit lower key so the voices get richer, and of course, that's what Willie's best at, and it was in a great key for both of us to sing with kind of the warmer, rich feel, and I thought our voices worked well together, and was just thrilled with how it came out.
Have I mentioned the website?
Oh yeah, what is it? Is it just www. Nils Lofgren?
Yeah, it's the www.nilslofgren.com, and we just gave it a facelift, and Dick and Linda Bangham, who run it for me out of Maryland, where I grew up, I've got a lot of good stuff on there. I've probably got a few, there's a few free downloads of tracks I'm proud of that didn't make the last record or two.
Yep, we have one we're going to play tonight.
Really like. There's a free download of my song Shine Silently,
yep,
a nice long
that.
Video
it's,
from the
it's on the power book, huh?
Live yeah. Acoustic record that just didn't make the live acoustic DVD, rather. So we're offering some free things, and then there's some ringtone downloads, and just some different items that people, I got a guitar school. I've just posted 4 1-hour guitar lessons. They're kind of intermediate or a little past beginner, but it's very primitive, me and my studio, but I slow things down for you. I'll play something and then really talk you through it very slowly, and it's kind of something I've started too, to try to do some guitar lessons from home and people can download. So I've got 4 posted, and actually the next big project when I get home off the road is to take that Youngstown solo from the Bruce Springsteen Madison Square Garden DVD. That may take 3 lessons to get through. That's a big piece. But that's just something I'm trying now for guitarists that are, you know, it's not high tech at all, but it's good sound, and I try to zoom into my hands a little bit and just offer some guitar lessons now. So the website is something that's going to keep building for me, and hopefully people will get it, you know, check it out and find things that are of interest.
That's very generous of you to pass down the knowledge like that in the open forum that the internet is. Very generous.
Well you know, it's I check with a lot of my friends locally, and they all charge like, you know, $40-$50 for an hour, so mine are just $15 for an hour, and I wanted it to not be some, it's not some big 3-camera shoot. I mean, it's just 1 camera, and I zoom in. It's kind of homegrown, but I found out when I did the first Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp that if I'm sitting around with a bunch of people that want to learn, I realize I have quite a bit to offer in the field of rock and roll, and I enjoy it. So this is a way to kind of do that from home, and thanks to the internet, hopefully reach people all around the world slowly but surely. We're just starting, so the numbers are small, but I'm hoping to build it into a pretty decent thing and get people that are regulars and try to post a lesson at least every month.
Can you tell us some more about that Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp? That sounds intriguing.
Well, they started it in the early 90s. Actually, Clarence Clemons, my good buddy from the East Street Band, was there with me. And actually, I did one a couple years ago just as a guest. I wasn't one of the counselors, so to speak. But in the first one, I was there for 3 days. People sign up. And, you know, there's seminars, there's guitar lessons, there's jam sessions every day. You have people like Lou Gramm from Foreigner, one of my favorite singers, and Mark Rivera was there from the Billy Joel Band. And we just get together and teach people and play. And I just found that when you're sitting there, it doesn't matter how advanced or beginning people are on a guitar, if they want to learn, you always find something to teach them, and they focus and pay attention. And I thought it was really great, and I really enjoyed it. So that's the kind of thing, at least through the lessons, I can do. And I just took to it and felt like a natural progression for me. And it was a chance to, I mean, you know, you play shows, you go back to your little hotel room or big hotel room, it doesn't matter. Can be a nice 4 Seasons with Bruce or Ringo or Neil Young, or it can be the Motel 6 with my own bands or Holiday Inn Express, nothing wrong with that. But, you know, all of a sudden you're just by yourself, and it's just kind of weird, you know, because the whole thing is about interaction with people. So I find that that's something that means a lot to me. And after my shows, I'll go out to a little table and sign CDs and T-shirts for an hour and talk to anyone and answer questions, and just it's just kind of an informal hang that you that's afforded me, because I'm not, you know, in this big giant arena thing where with security and all that, and it's a real one-on-one you know, meaningful contact with fans that you know, it's I'm excited that the music means something special, and my job is to make each show a special night for them. And it's kind of a nice little after party, and I can, you know, sell some CDs and talk to people about the music and the show. And it's just something that I like to do, and especially in my own shows, I get to do every night.
That's great. That's how I got the Acoustic Live CD, was at one of your shows, and you were gracious enough to sign that for me.
Yeah, that's one of the better ones, I think, as my fans get older. And it's funny, I walk around or travel around with, like, Nat King Cole CDs and Tony Bennett, and I love gentler stuff just to keep an ambiance around me in the crazy world we're in. And, you know, when it comes to making a racket, I just prefer to make it myself now. I mean, I'll put on some heavier music, but I find myself listening to mellow stuff just to try to find some peace. And the Acoustic Live CD and the DVD really came out well, and it is a little bit more of a intimate, peaceful. Both those projects are a little more reflective of that, but... you know, I'm just carrying on, and hopefully people keep checking out the website and check some of the things out that we have to offer, including some of the free downloads.
Yeah.
Tell me about the track on the double live CD where all your brothers play together, and they recorded it in your living room or someplace?
Well, on the double live CD, which is very aggressive, I had started doing a version of Every Time, I'm sorry, First Time Ever I Saw Your Face,
right,
by Roberta Flack.
Yep.
My mother and my doctor, Dr. Dave Dolman, kept bugging me that, you know, they wanted it on CD. And so even though the band CD was live and very aggressive, we went into my basement and we set up, a buddy of mine engineered it, and we just... all my brothers and Paul Bell, who's a brilliant guitarist that played a lot on the Acoustic Live album, we sat down there and just, you know, did the song live. You know, we play it a couple times, take a break, play it a few times, and then picked a completely live performance of that song, which wound up kind of like the last song. It's a very gentle, peaceful ending to the double live band CD.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And, you know, reflective of course, it the same kind of thing that you'd find in the Acoustic Live album, but when we did that album, at that time I hadn't started doing that song yet. And it was a song I started singing, and people liked it, so we thought we'd make it available that way.
Right on.
Yeah. Okay, you got a new one, right? Whatever Happened to Muscatel?
Yeah, this great author, Clive Cussler, who's written this many books, but there's a Dirk Pitt series. I don't know if you're familiar with Clive, but he's one of the best-selling authors on the New York Times best-selling list in the last 30 years. He writes about this guy, Dirk Pitt. It's a fictitious character. He's like a 007 in blue jeans who's, you know, raising some sunken ship and then runs into, you know, big world problems and solves them with his buddy. But the neat thing is, in real life, Clive has this NUMA. It's called NUMA, National Underwater Marine Agency. And the books are very educational, as they are, you know, dramatic adventure stories. And in real life, Clive is an archaeologist and a deep sea diver, and he's actually raised like 50 or 60 of the most significant shipwrecks in the last 30 years with his in real life. In fact, I just had dinner with him a couple nights ago to celebrate my birthday. We've become friends, and I'm just a big fan of his. It was way back on the Ringo tour in '89, actually. The first Ringo Starr All-Star Band tour, I was reading one of his books, and I thought, this guy's, you know, just a monster writer, and maybe I should try to seek him out. So I kind of did some friendly stalking through his publisher, and I got him to a show with his family. We've been friends ever since. And he always used to say, hey, I want to write a corny country song someday. And I said, well, if you're serious, I'll help you out. That was about a year ago, and we chipped away at this song, Whatever Happened to Muscatel. It's kind of a reminiscing about great liquors of the past, or great rock gut liquors of the past. And it really came out great. It's not a corny country song anymore, and I've recorded it. We're just about done with it, and we've got, you know, had a little sing-along with Clive and some of his family and mine. And anyway, we're Dick and Linda from my who run my website are putting together a great download package that we're going to offer, I hope, in a couple weeks. But it's a great tune and really came out cool, and that's like a project I've been working on with Clive now for a while, so I'm excited about that.
Yeah, what about Trance? Neil Young's Trance, was that?
Now that was a fabulous, we actually, that's a great groundbreaking record. You know, Neil was one of the first people when the synclavier came out and technology, he wrote this genius album giving machines a soul. And I kind of, just not speaking for Neil, but reading some of the interviews he did, you know, the Bridge School, which is a fabulous school that creates these machines that allow really severely handicapped kids to, like, you know, whatever control they have, maybe like move a big ball disc ball on a in a table or something, and control a train set or control something, allows them to have some power and do some things even with their handicaps. It's a very groundbreaking thing. And best I can figure, Neil wrote these great songs kind of speaking, you know, about these machines or from their perspective and giving them personalities and souls. And of course, this record company decided the record was too un-Neil Young-like and couldn't be released. And while he was doing that big battle with them, he took the Trans band to Hawaii and we recorded a whole album of songs. And maybe four or five of the songs wound up on the Trans album with all the stuff he did on his own with the machines. And it was just a groundbreaking record, and we wound up touring England for 6 weeks. I'm sorry, Europe. England, Europe, all of it. And it was just a crazy, beautiful show. You know, you go from playing Old Man on the After the Gold Rush piano that I played, you know, on during the After the Gold Rush records. We had that upright piano, and then we put on these vocoders, you know, headsets where you trigger kind of synthesized voices. And it was just a very incredible marriage of new technology with the old, great, old school rock and roll and folk, country, and hard rock and grunge and all of it. And only somebody like Neil could kind of marry it all together on that tour. And it was, for me, a great experience to be a part of it.
Hey, what was it like touring with Ringo?
Well, that was a dream come true. It was in 85 after a Wembley Stadium show. We all went to Ringo's birthday party, and he had a jam room set up. We got to jam together, and which is a great honor for me because the Beatles really turned me on to rock and roll, and I think they have the greatest body of recorded music in history.
Amen.
And he gave me his number and said, hey, stay in touch. So I did, and I'd go to England every year and play, and sometimes him and Barbara would come to my acoustic shows. And in 89 he put his first all-star band together and gave me a call, asked me to be a part of it. And that was, you know, certainly one of the greatest, as great a band as I've ever been. And you had Dr. John, Billy Preston, Joe Walsh, Clarence Clemens, Jim Keltner, Rick Danko, Levon Helm from the band. And that was really, you know, one of my greatest experiences, being in a band for 4 months with Ringo and that group of characters.
I bet.
So that was, you know, again, a great honor, and he keeps going out and doing that. I got to do the first two bands, the first two All-Star bands again in 92, and again, I kind of owe it to Bruce and the E Streeters. I've been in that band for 23 years because it was really the band that got invited to the show, or after the show, to Ringo's birthday party, which led to, you know, that friendship and getting to play in some great bands with him.
How come you never got invited to play in The Sopranos then?
Hey, I did. They actually used Black Books from the Acoustic Live album for the second season, David Chase.
Cool.
My wife gave him a CD after an E Street Band show at Madison Square Garden, yeah, like in 2000 or something. And then him and his wife loved the CD, and he called a few weeks later and said he wanted to use Black Books in the second season of The Sopranos. So that's the version off the Acoustic Live CD, and also it's actually on the second, the Sopranos put out a CD compilation of the music they used in the second one. I think it's called Pepper and Eggs or something, and it's on there also.
Wow. Talking about that tune, that's originally from Damaged Goods, right?
Yeah, it was originally done kind of a strange, like, hip-hop gospel treatment, harsh treatment.
Yeah.
It's kind of a real dark country song. And then I did an acoustic live version, which completely had a different feel to it and flavor, kind of a little more haunting and intimate. And that was the version David Chase used in The Sopranos. And actually, there's a great live version on the live acoustic DVD
okay.
That came out great, too.
How did you get Branford Marsalis involved in the Damaged Goods CD?
Well, actually, that was another beautiful accident thanks to the East Street Band. After the Tunnel of Love tour, Bruce said we were all going to go, asked us to all participate in the Amnesty International tour, and we traveled around the world in this giant 747 with Sting, Peter Gabriel, Tracy Chapman, and Yusu Nadur in their bands. And Tracy was solo, and the rest of us had bands. So we got to do these great shows, and two of my heroes, Peter Gabriel and Sting, were there every night. And I, of course, got to get to see them play, you know, five times a week, and have a ringside seat on the side of the stage was an honor. And because we were all together, you know, in one plane, one bus, got to be friends with a lot of different musicians, and one in particular, Branford, who I loved. We became good friends, and we went and played basketball all over the world, the two of us, either on the teams or together. We just played basketball everywhere we went and find games to play, and we actually got through the whole tour undefeated, which was great. And, you know, had a ball, and had just kind of maintain a friendship, and when he did the Buckshot LaFunk record, he asked me to come and do some session work for him, which was a great honor.
So what do you have, a good medium-range jump shot or what?
You know, I'm more the point guard. I'm like, you know, I drive and pass is my thing. I can drive and score, but my best thing is to drive. I'm a pretty good passer, and if I have to, once in a while, my medium-range jumper can fall.
There's another career for you if the music thing ever ends.
Yeah, well, if there's ever a, you know,
senior tour, right?
Well, guys, league, I'll be there.
What's David Letterman really like when you're on his show?
Well, you know, I only know him from the show, and he was very friendly, of course. And I think once I did a stupid human trick where he held my trampoline and I did the backflip back in the early days. But I don't really know David other than doing his show. And, of course, he's been friendly and cordial because I showed up and was professional and did my job. I've sat in with his bands and actually his old drummer, Steve Jordan, who's a fabulous drummer and producer and musician, has just we've done a lot of work together on Patti Springsteen's new record. I'm not sure when it's coming out, but her last record too, 23rd Street Lullaby, we got to play for a couple weeks and do some TV promo and tour, and I love Steve and working with him. So, you know, we go way back to the beginning when I started jamming with the original Letterman band, and again, my brief experience with David was that, you know, he's my favorite talk show host, and I know Johnny Carson was hoping he'd take over that spot, but he's obviously, you know, great at what he does, and that's my limited experience with him.
Cool. And I had another question. The fat lady on the cover of the record, what was the story behind? Is there a story behind that?
Yeah, actually, that's way back in 75, I think my solo album was just about done, my first one for A&M, and Ed Karoff, who's a famous old photographer from L.A., and at the time, he took a lot of the great Hendrix pictures. You know the picture where Jimmy's kneeling over his guitar on fire?
Yep.
That's Ed Karoff. And I had a photo shoot to do the cover, and it was like 10 a.m. in the morning, and I hate photo shoots. I'm not a poser. I'm not good at it. So I showed up with a bottle of Grand Marnier to help me through the session. And I just showed up with that outfit on, and Ed freaked out and said, "Oh my God, you got to see this poster. It's got the same colors in it." He walked me out back, and he had this giant old canvas circus poster. It was an original from like the 20s or 30s at the time. The biggest man in the world was 700 and some pounds. And, you know, he had this poster, and I just happened to have the same type of colors on in my shirt and wardrobe. And he said, "Stand in front of it for a minute." And he took a Polaroid. We looked at it and went, "Geez, that's got to be the cover." So, you know, it was just kind of a fortuitous
serendipitous
accident that I showed up in that outfit, and he had that poster in his backyard.
That's great.
I call it the Fat Man album, but, you know, it's technically just my self-titled first solo record, Nils Lofgren.
I always thought it was a lady.
No, fattest man in the world, I think. I mean, I could be wrong, but we all remember it as a largest man alive at the time.
And what was it like as a 17-year-old playing with Neil Young and stuff like that?
Well, my band Grin was about to go to L.A., and I was very kind of freaked out, having been become a professional musician in a business I knew nothing about, especially in the mid-60s. And just before we left LA, I always snuck backstage, tried to ask questions of my musical heroes, and I was familiar with Neil Young's work with Buffalo Springfield. I had no idea how great he was on his own until I snuck backstage. I bought a ticket to see a show at the Cellar Door in D.C., and Neil was kind enough to let me play a couple songs on his Martin for him that he liked, and he got me a cheeseburger and Coke. And I watched four shows over 2 days and spent the afternoons hanging out with him, and he was very supportive and encouraging. And you know, he said, when you get to L.A., look me up, and I did. Long, long story short, David Briggs, his producer, kind of took my band Grin under his wing, which led to, after a lot of little ups and downs with different managers and agents, David produced our four albums. And, you know, while that journey was taking place, I was living in Topanga Canyon with David Briggs, and I saw Neil regularly, and he would jam with my band Grin at the Corral, the local bar there. We became the house band. And, you know, when I was 18, making my way with Grin and David as our mentor, you know, Neil said he's doing this after the Gold Rush project, wanted me to play mostly piano and a little acoustic guitar and sing on it, which, of course, was an amazing experience for a young 18-year-old just a year in as a professional musician. And to this day, I still, you know, Neil's one of my, the main inspirers, and I think as great a writer as we have and performer, and fortunately, he's still out doing it for us.
Who else is an inspirer to you, like from when you were a kid?
Well, the Beatles really, and the Stones turned me on to rock and roll, the Beatles in particular. I was a classical accordionist, and they had these more sophisticated melodies and harmonies that caught my ear. And I fell in love with all rock and roll, the old blues, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf. You know, one of my greatest heroes musically is Ray Charles, sadly, who's gone now. You know, Sam Cooke. I fell in love with Motown, the old R&B, Stax Volt stuff. Got to see Muddy Waters play. In fact, I snuck back into the same dressing room I met Neil Young, and Mr. Waters was yelling, throwing cards on the table with his buddies, and I asked if I could just stand in the corner and watch him play cards, and he said, sure, and then I saw his shows. And, yeah, I was lucky to... One of the advantages of being 56, if you love music, I grew up in the 60s, and there was an explosion of music. Roy Buchanan was, you know, my favorite guitarists were really Jimi Hendrix, Jeff Beck, and Roy Buchanan. Roy was playing locally in the D.C. area, and I got to be buddies with him, and that's where I first heard harmonics sound like bells,
yeah,
guitar. And he used to show me how to do it, but I couldn't play with a flat pick, so I learned how to get that sound with a thumb pick. And, you know, and then for like the thematic rhythm stuff, you got Pete Townsend, Keith Richards, of course the Lees, Jimmy Page, Eric Clapton, just so many great guitarists, and a lot of them still around. But it was really Hendrix who I followed around a lot, and Jeff Beck. I snuck backstage and kind of got to know Jeff and Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood on the first Truth tours, the first Jeff Beck Group tours in America. And to this day, you know, Jeff's my, I think, the greatest living guitarist, and I'll go see him whenever I can.
I personally, like any artist, I wonder if some of their story songs are based on true stories. Like, and the one I usually think of is No Mercy. Is that based on a true story, or is it just like...
Well, it was inspired by a true experience. Basically, in the late 70s, I started taking karate lessons at this local place in Kensington, Maryland, Junri Karate. And I never learned how to fight. I just took it for exercise, and I fell out of it years ago. But I really was into it, and this guy, Jeff Smith, still a really cool guy and friend, he was the light heavyweight champion of the world. He ran the studio, and his buddy Danny Bocagno, who were still buddies. And I just went through the few beginner belts, but they started taking me on trips with their karate team to work the corner. And, you know, it struck me like you got these really well-dressed in suits, gracious young men, very honorable and to their opponents, very polite, and, you know, cordial and formal, shaking hands, bowing, and then they get into the ring and try to kill each other. And they'd come back, these guys would come back to the corner I was working with Jeff, and I'd have I was the guy with the bucket that they spit the blood and teeth into. And it just blew my mind, because the juxtaposition of all this, you know, honor and cordiality versus this violence and mayhem. And it, I got the theme of the idea of how we're in this dog-eat-dog world where a lot of times, you know, our tendencies, you want to try to be kind and giving, and the world puts you in a corner once you're an adult male in Western civilization a lot of times where you're in a place where you have to kind of, you know, it's either you lose something you want or need or want to defend, or you, you know, you have to, like, lose it to some other guy, or you have to fight for it. And it's sad that our world is so greedy and corrupt and kind of like that. But it was basically a metaphor for life where, and I took the idea of this, you know, young fighter that just reveres his profession and has a lot of honor, but all of a sudden, his whole journey's been to become a great fighter, and now he's in the ring with, like, his hero, who's older, and he's either got to destroy him or let his career go down the tubes, because it's the professional world. It's not just some, you know, what do you call it, you know, exhibition match where he can, like, kind of graciously, you know, like you let your kid beat you at ping pong or something. You can't do that when you're an adult. A lot of times you get in a corner where you just got to fight for what's yours and take it, and even sometimes it means hurting somebody else. And it was just kind of a metaphor for the dog-eat-dog aspect of Western civilization that I think it's one of my better songs and better lyrics, but that's really where the idea was born from, was that work with Jeff Smith and his karate teams working the corners.
Interesting. Wow, that's
a great tune. That's a great tune, no doubt about it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's funny. I went to see The Police a couple nights ago, and I just, huge, huge fan, love the show, always been a great fan of Sting's. I've just gotten to know him a little bit on the Amnesty International tour, again, where I met Branford, and it's funny, one of my great moments, because Sting is just this, you know, musical genius, and he's one of those guys who just, despite all the chaos and craziness, he's just so dedicated and disciplined, like Bruce Springsteen. You know, they're just so friggin' disciplined about, you know, I mean, I just have great admiration for both of them. And we were at a bar early on in the Amnesty International tour, and you know, it was so cool. We were hanging out with all these great musicians and getting to know them, and we were having some drinks, getting ready to fly to God knows where, India or somewhere, in some exotic place in Europe. We're at a bar, and we're all just hanging out, and, you know, Sting comes up to me at the bar and, you know, says hello, and we're talking, and I've gotten to know him a little bit through the tour, and everyone's great and cool, and I'll never forget, you know, Sting looked at me and said, "Nils, I'm only going to say this once to you," and I was like, uh-oh, what's that? What's this going to be? And he looked at me and said, "I just want to tell you, No Mercy is a really good song." And I looked at him and I went, "Well, thank you, Sting. Coming from you, that really does mean a lot." And it did, and it still does, because, you know, he's a massive talent that's really, you know, pushing himself and continues to grow and learn, which is kind of the journey I hope to stay on too.
Okay, I got two. First of all, you have a MySpace that I learned recently, because the only way I could actually send you anything was I had to make a MySpace of my own.
Well, you know, you can always send stuff to my listserv. It's free on my website. I check those every day too.
All right. The other thing was, I was curious about lyrics. I've been looking for some of your lyrics, and they're apparently in your noggin. I have a little trouble finding some of them.
Yeah, you know, a lot of them were printed in the records, but unfortunately, a lot of those are out of print.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a strange thing. In fact, you know, Mary Pruitt, who's helping me with my MySpace, and Dick and Linda Bangham, who are running the website, we discussed possibly at some point getting all the lyrics printed accurately and available through my website and MySpace, but I realized we're talking about a couple hundred songs. So that's a pretty formidable task, and it's one that I just haven't taken on yet, but it is a good idea. So I'm sorry if you're missing some of the lyrics, but I'll be happy to fill in any blanks if I can.
Okay, we'll deal with it in email. How's that?
Okay.
I wanted to ask you about the Cry Tough album. For some reason, that one has been very difficult to get on CD. As far as I know, only available as an import. Is there some reason it can't be released?
Well, you know, it's just silly commerce stuff. Again, there is a link on my website to Record and Tape Traders.
Yeah.
My buddy Steve Smolin, they have a mail business That you usually can get most of all my old records through them on CD for a reasonable price. That's where I try. But what happens is the records go out of print, and if you're not a big artist with a lot of hits, they don't print anymore. I've approached A&M, and then it got bought out by Universal. I've approached, you know, regularly I'll call the presidents, and I'm not crying the blues, but a long story short, it's like they say, look, Nils, you know, it's just not worth it. Our machine's so big, if we crank it up to print your old records, we're just not going to sell that many, so basically we're just going to let you remain extinct. And my manager, Anson, and I have actually gone and said, because, you know, it costs about $1.25, I guess, to make a CD, and said, look, how about if we give you, because, you know, understandably, on their books, I owe them hundreds of thousands of dollars because I didn't have a hit record.
Right. Yep.
So I say, how about if I give you $5 a CD? Just sell me 1,000 of them, and I'll just pass them on to my fans through the website. And, you know, basically the answer has been, look, our machine is so big that to crank it up for that few sales is not worth it, so no. So it's at a point now where the next step is for me to do something a bit dishonorable and bootleg my old music. I may do.
That's great.
I'm not doing it today, but that's the game. And I'm not trying to whine about it. I'm one of many artists that made some, I hope, good records for the fans that didn't have a hit. So when the supply ran out, they didn't print anymore, and that's why it's so difficult to get them, and the company regularly refuses to print them again. And since they own it, I either have to, like, just be disappointed about their decision, or I have to do something like a little more ruthless and bootleg myself, which is the next step, which may happen.
Well, how about if you bought the rights back from them? Would
they don't,
charge you with...
they don't want to sell them.
Well,
they don't want to sell them, but
they don't
want to use
them.
What is that?
If they're not making money on them, why don't they want to sell them?
You know, it's listen, the music industry has always been crazy. It's not a lot of common sense involved. And, you know, these guys are... you know, running really big companies that are in trouble right now. So, you know, I mean, I'm like, look, let me give you $5 a CD. You're making almost $4 for each piece. But, and that's my answer. But, you know, they're like, I mean, I can't. If they say, yeah, you know, we'll sell you your catalog, you owe us like $500,000.
Yeah,
I don't
right.
have $500,000 to give to Universal for like a back catalog.
That's true.
I mean, I just wanted to buy some of my old CDs and sell them, and I'd offered them like 5 times what it cost to make, and that's not even something they would consider. So it's just one of those things. It's just business. It's not. I don't want to cry about it, but yeah, sure. I'm disappointed. I asked a lawyer, like, hey, if they're making my old music extinct, would I have a legal leg to stand on to ask for it back? And the answer is no. You signed your rights away. That's the music business. So it's no big deal. It's just what it is. Maybe I'll start bootlegging. I mean, actually, somebody just released the Wonderland album. Some great guy called, and somehow he finagled the rights to Wonderland.
Wow.
That came out in April, which is one of my favorite records. So he's going to start working. You know, we talked about it. He's going to work on maybe like packaging two together, like Cry Tough and I Came to Dance or something. So people are working on it, but maddeningly enough, every time we've gone to the companies, or I have, the answer's been no.
But what about the iTunes option? I mean, they're not don't even have to do the $1.50 or whatever it is to make the CD. They just, you know, set up the deal.
Yeah, well, basically the deal is, when I, back in the old days, and right now, if you sign with a record company, you relinquish a lot of rights. You can give them good ideas, but they have the right to act on it or not, and they're not acting on any good ideas I have. So, you know, I play the songs live. I make new music I'm proud of. I'm kind of got this great new business I've started, and my future is through the internet and website, even though it's kind of intimidating technology. It gives me the freedom I've always had.
Yeah, us too.
And hopefully, as time goes by, maybe I forget his name, I'm sorry to say, but some guy figured out how to get Wonderland and release it. Well, maybe he'll figure out how to get some of my older stuff. He is working on it.
No, we'll play it instead. We're going to do 4 hours of your stuff tonight.
We'll play a bunch of it tonight.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, I mean, I'm grateful I've got, you know, so over the last 38 years, I actually have 4 hours of stuff you can play. And, of course, a lot of great stuff I've done with Bruce or Neil Young or Ringo too, but I'm thrilled to be alive, and hopefully down the road, you know, some of those things will loosen up. Maybe some of the older music will be easier to get in CD form.
We're thrilled to be talking to you, that you took the time to be so gracious as to talk to us.
Well, you know, I've got a lot of good stories. I've been at it a long time, and I guess one of the good things about not having a hit record and getting whisked off into that world at a young age is, I mean, I love to be in bands, and to have people like Neil Young or Ringo or Bruce ask me to join their bands, it's really a joy for me to... I'm very happy to be a band leader. I love it. I'm trying to get better at it. I feel like I am. It's what I do. But to take a break from being the boss once in a while and just getting to be a musician and be in a great band with someone else doing all that other stuff is really you know, good for my musical soul. And I come back to my own music kind of refreshed. And with Sacred Weapon, just accidentally, the last two East Street Band tours, you know, we got Steve back in the band, which was fabulous. And it kind of completed the group. And because we got four guitar players now with Patty and me, you don't need four guitars. So I became the swing guy. I learned a little pedal steel, bottleneck, dobro, lap steel, and six-string banjo. So when I did the last record, Sacred Weapon, of my own, all of a sudden I had these new instruments. And, I mean, it was fun. I'd never written a song on pedal steel guitar in my life. And while I was tracking the thing, I got this idea and this lick, and I turned into this song, Trouble, which I love from the yep. record. And then the bottleneck thing, the first couple songs I ever wrote on bottleneck dobro were In Your Hands, and then this little blues piece, Pay Your Woman. So it's all kind of a part of a journey moving forward, learning and growing slowly but surely. And if you just stay open and try to keep learning stuff, you never know how it relates back to your own stuff or when you're in someone else's band. And I'm just, you know, again, I'm still hoping to get better at what I do, and maybe through the help of people like you and my internet business, maybe someday I'll have whatever, a hit record or whatever you want to call it. I mean, the goal is, when you make music, for me anyway, is to share it. And the more right. people that get turned on to it, the better. I'm thrilled to be going next month and doing a few acoustic shows for a few hundred people. I take that as seriously as any show, no matter what size. But of course, my dream is still maybe, you know, get popular enough to play theaters with 3,000 people coming, so you have your own sound and lights, you can control the show and give a better quality show. But something I've gotten really good at and take pride in is, I show up in a bar with could be an average sound system, could be a broken sound system. Me and my crew, my job is to fix everything and do a special night for whoever shows up. And you know, we take pride in that, and I get to work with good people, and you know, that's the journey I'm on. And got a cool family, great wife who understands and knows I need to sing and play, and that'll be, hopefully, health permitting, something I'll do the rest of my life.
Well, that's the true soul of rock and roll.
Yeah, thank God. I mean, I got tired of traveling 25 years ago, but thank God, when I get up in front of an audience now, it actually has more value and more like potential for some kind of healing experience, in addition, of course, to doing a show and getting judged and hoping people want to come back next time.
What do they call a musician with no girlfriend?
Homeless.
Yeah,
that's
exactly right.
Yeah,
you heard that one. Okay.
Hey, yeah, there's some good musician jokes, but hey, we, you know, fortunately, I have trouble leaving home now because I got a great home. My wife Amy, who's a Jersey girl, we live out in Scottsdale. She's an amazing professional cook, but I've got three dogs, two cats, a teenage stepson, and gets harder to say goodbye. But once I'm out there singing and playing, it's it has more healing value than it even used to, thank God, because that makes the rest of the day the work. And actually, once you get to walk out and play and sing, it's almost not, I mean, you're focused, you try hard, of course, but it's a very more joyful experience than it was when I was younger, where it was more like scary and challenging and you're not sure you can do it. And I still get excited, but I'm not really nervous. I'm just kind of excited. And I know that if I just, you know, practice a little bit, sing a little few days out, that, you know, it'll be okay. And my best will be good enough, and it'll be a special night because it's something I've worked hard at for 38 years. And, you know, I could have worked harder, but I've always managed to keep some musical project in front of me to not get stagnant. And so I'm thrilled to be able to sing tomorrow night with some friends, and got some shows next month, and we'll keep posting them on my website, and you know, just try to keep at it.
Well, Nils, I'm a chef myself, so I'd like to know what special meal your wife makes for you when you finally come home after that.
Well, you know, she can cook anything. She's really a master cook. It's kind of like her calling. But you know, her best thing, she makes all these incredible soups that are like meals, and all kinds of different soups. And one dish in particular, salmon over red lentils.
Ooh, okay. Man.
Which is just this amazing dish she makes. But everything she cooks is great. And, you know, I can't cook anything, so I'm fascinated by someone who can just whip stuff together that really, if you're a cook, you know. You go to all these restaurants, even expensive ones, a lot of times you eat very average meals. They're not bad, they're not great. So when you taste great food, especially simple food, you realize what's going on here and how come there's so many average restaurants out there. But that's the difference between an artist or somebody has a calling for it and a real gift, or someone that's just doing it.
Exactly.
Well, you can, if you know what it should be tasting like, you can tell them, well, how come it doesn't taste like this?
Yeah, I've had to lower my standards since I've been married to Amy for 11 years.
Okay, yeah, I just had one other request.
Sure.
Could you come to Providence sometime? Jeez.
Lupo's.
Lupo's, yeah. Really?
Man, I used to play there all the time. I don't know why they don't invite me back anymore.
I don't know. Well,
Lupo's doesn't exist.
No, there you go.
It's at the Strand.
Yeah, it's changed venue. Lupo's moved two times. I don't know if you remember the original Lupo's, a little place. And then,
yeah, I played there.
Yep, and then there was the second Lupo's.
Big one, yeah.
Yep.
Played there.
Yeah, I saw you at that one. And then now Lupo's is in an old movie theater, an old Strand theater.
Wow.
So
which
they,
is pretty cool.
The booking there has been kind of weird and
weak.
It's a bigger venue, so they.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the Providence crowds have always been great. I have really fond memories of playing at Lupo's, and, it was always a great crowd there. And so hopefully I'll get back through there before too long.
Well, okay. Nils, thanks for taking the time to talk to us, and. We got this on tape, so we'll be playing it again for people, those who weren't listening live.
It'll be on our website. It'll be on our website.
Yeah. That is great, fellas. And please, just stay in touch with me through Mary or whatever. I'm happy to do a follow-up anytime. I'm going to keep, getting stuff out on my website. And thanks for directing people to my website and turning them on to some different projects I've got going.
If you don't mind, we'd like to link.
Can we put a link?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I would love that.
That'll be done very soon.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate the time and letting people know I got some new music out there. It means a lot.
No problem. Thank you so much.
All right, good luck with the show tonight. Thanks for everything.
All right, you have a good time at your show.
All right, you guys take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay.